Hello, this is Christian Okoye, former Kansas City Chief. You are listening to Grilling Truth.
Welcome to the Grilling Truth NFL Legends Show, brought to you by Gridiron Mo, a new interactive football app where you get to call what you think the offense or defense should do during a live NFL game and see what all other fans have called also. Check out Gridiron Mo at www.gridironmo.com. As always, for the Legends Show, I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster. And our guest today played at the University of Nebraska for the legendary Tom Osborne, went on to play for the Cincinnati Bengals. They had 9.5 sacks in the 88 season, helped get the Bengals to the Super Bowl. Help me welcome to the show, Jim Scow.
Good afternoon.
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, great to have you on the show. Let's just start off, when you started playing football, who some of your early influences were?
My earliest influences were the Kansas City Chiefs, because I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. And the Kansas City Chiefs were pretty good when I was a little kid. And I remember two players, Willie Lanier and Buck Buchanan, being some of my favorite players.
Yeah.
Those are old names.
Yeah, Willie Lanier, number 63, I think it was.
Yeah, he was a stud.
Yeah, well, both of them were. And I wrote an article about that 69 Chiefs team. I still think it's one of the top five or six defenses in NFL history, and I think they're the most underrated Super Bowl champion of all time.
Yeah, very much so.
I mean, you had Pro Bowlers all over the defense. You had guys like, I think Johnny Johnson was a DB for them that probably should be in the Hall of Fame. And, of course,
they got,
you had Lynn
Dawson.
They
had good pedigrees, too. I ended up playing with a couple of the sons of some of those players. Eric Buchanan was a teammate of mine in Nebraska, and Brad Tyer was a teammate of mine in Nebraska.
Yeah. Well, Ed, we'll just go ahead and we'll go to that. I mean, what took you to the University of Nebraska? What made you want to further your career there?
Well, you know, I was recruited by most of the central states schools and things like that, but Nebraska was always on my mind because I grew up in Omaha. I mean, it was only about an hour away from Lincoln, Nebraska, where the university is located. And they had such a lure back then that basically I was just a hometown kid signing up.
So you get there. I mean, you played for a legendary coach, Tom Osborne, who was preceded by Bob Devaney, one of the best programs in the country. What was it like to play for Coach Osborne?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. You know, Coach Osborne was very involved in the offense back then, so you didn't see him too much if you played defense. I mean, you'd see him in passing and say hi and all that kind of stuff. But Charlie McBride, the defense coordinator, defensive line coach, is the one that I reported to.
Yeah, and that was the next guy I was going to ask you about. I mean, he was a great football coach, too. I think a lot of people forget because he stayed with Osborne instead of trying to go out on his own. You want to talk a little bit about Charlie?
Yeah, Charlie was a great guy. He taught you how to two-gap and taught you how to pass rush and basically taught you how to be disciplined. Charlie was considered probably the top assistant coach in the country for probably a good 10, 15 years. I remember that there were a lot of teams in the NFL that were trying to get him to leave college ranks and actually go coach in the NFL.
Did he ever take a college job anywhere, a head coach?
Nope. As a matter of fact, I think he retired in, 1997 from Nebraska. So that was basically, before that, he had coached at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Where he had actually coached Mike Webster.
Well, that wouldn't be a bad thing to do. One of the greatest centers of all time.
Yeah, really.
So talk a little bit about your Nebraska career. The thing I always remembered was the Friday after Thanksgiving, Oklahoma-Nebraska, Barry Switzer against Tom Osborne. What are your recollections of the rivalry?
Oh, it was a lot of fun, especially the one thing that I do remember is that whenever you played in Norman, Oklahoma, and if they scored touchdowns, you always forgot that they had this cannon that was really loud, and it scared the crap out of me every time. But, yeah, I had a lot of fun, got to play against some really good teams. I remember when I was a senior, we played against them in Norman, and they had a whole bunch of good players on that team.
Yeah, that would have been the Bosworth team.
Jackson, the tight end.
That won the Nationals. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you go on, you get there. I mean, the game that stands out to me, which we talked a little bit off air there, would have been the 1984 Orange Bowl and the Nebraska-Miami game. What do you remember about the game, and should Osborne have went for two or not?
Yeah, I think he should have gone for two. I remember the game. I remember being so disappointed at the end. We had a team, especially on offense, that had so many good players. You had Turner Gill. You had Mike Rozier. You had Irving Fryer. Irving Fryer played about 18 years in the NFL. And then you had a whole bunch of offensive linemen that went on to play in the NFL. I think Dean Steinkuhler was on that team. Scott Reardon was on that team. I mean, it was just such a good set of players. It was amazing how powerful the offense was.
Yeah, and I mean, you go into the game, you're a big favorite, you end up losing the game. But I'll tell you, the one thing about it is, I think Osborne going for two there, I think got him a lot of respect around the country, though.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it shows a lot of character saying, listen, I'm not going to eat it and take a tie and then have some sort of distraction going on for the next 2 or 3 years. I'm going to go ahead and try to win it outright.
And yeah, so when people think of him, even though it was a loss, they think about how he went to try to win the game, where I think you look at a coach like Eric Parsegian, I mean, the game that's always brought up is the 66 tie with Michigan State, where he just sat on the ball in the last minute.
Kind of shows the difference in character of certain coaches.
Yeah, and that's why Nebraska is usually better than Notre Dame.
But, yes. Notre Dame's got some good teams lately.
Yeah, they got some good teams. I'm not a big Brian Kelly fan of since he left UC and the lurched the way he did. But, all right, let's go to draft day, 1986 draft. The Bengals, actually, I think the 86 draft is what caused the 88 Super Bowl run. I mean, if you look at that draft, you had Joe Kelly, Tim McGee, Lewis Billups, yourself, David Folger, Leon White. I mean, right there you had one, two, three. You got four starters on the 88 Super Bowl team there. What was your first thought when you got drafted by the Bengals?
My first thought was, I knew of the head coach, but I didn't know who it was. But he had actually called me right before he drafted, Sam White. And I was pretty excited. I knew he was a relatively new coach there as well. So I knew that there was some sort of regime change in the sense that they were kind of changing everything that they were doing. I was pretty excited about it. I actually was at a friend of mine's dad's restaurant/bar, actually watching my face show up on the television.
Yeah, a little bit different back then as it is now with the draft, but everything's a lot bigger with the NFL now than what it was. What was your first impression of Cincinnati and Coach Weish?
My first impression of Cincinnati was Northern Kentucky. That's where you have to fly into, and I was like, oh, it's so far away from downtown Cincinnati. And then I was taken to Spinney Field, and I don't know if you've ever been to Spinney Field?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was a joke.
Almost everybody that ever played for the Bengals, I don't even have to bring Spinney Field up. They bring it up, and it's usually their first impression of the Bengals, which is never a good thing.
No, it's not good because it's essentially down an alley, and a good long alley, maybe a half a city block long, and there's fences on both sides, and there's an abandoned trestle up there, you know, bridge, and then you basically go through the gate. And here's the practice facility. I get it.
Yeah, hoping you don't get mugged on the way.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's what Jason Buck on a couple weeks ago, and I think that was his first thought, too.
Yeah. You know, when you get everybody who does that, they all have their heads on a swivel when you're driving down that alley the first time you come down there because you're like, is this a joke? Is somebody going to kind of jump out of here and pull a prank on me or something?
All right, you get to the Bengals, your first training camp. Was there anybody, player or coach-wise, that kind of took you under their wing to help you out?
I think Dick LeBeau did a pretty good job at taking care of the rookies. He really did. He wanted to make sure that you got acclimated pretty well. I remember you remember Anthony Wendell's, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, so do
He's
I.
He's a hard one to forget.
I had been a holdout for about 10 days. I don't know what the whole issue was, but I had been a holdout for about 10 days. And so
I don't think there was ever a Bengal drafted in the 80s that wasn't a holdout.
Yeah,
at least
everybody held out. But that being said, they went through the first practice. We went through some drills and stuff. You've done the practice thing and everything, and all of a sudden they do the one-on-one pass rush. And, of course, they go, Scout, get in there with Anthony Munoz. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy's the best offensive lineman that's ever played. And I beat him on a no-touch. And I just had a head fake, and I beat him on a no-touch. And that was the longest camp that I've ever had in my life after that.
Wasn't going to let you beat him again, huh?
Not even remotely.
Yeah, and the great thing about Anthony Munoz is I think he's the greatest offensive lineman that ever lived. But I've actually had the opportunity to sit down and talk to him a couple times, and he is every bit as good a person as he was a player.
Oh, yeah, very, very wonderful individual. He really is quite the family man, and he's just really kind of off the field. He's actually just the kindest person you can ever meet.
Yeah. Let's go to the 87 season. The 86 season, I think you played most of the games, but you didn't become a starter yet. But the 86
I did at the
season,
end of the season.
At the end of the season, the Bengals were 10-6. I remember, I think it was the one where they got them in Boomer or somebody's restaurant. Well, we watched the Dolphins and Patriots kill the playoff dream. But that team had to have high expectations coming into the 87 season. You had to strike. What are your recollections of that season?
I remember that it being a little bit disjointed in the sense that there was a looming strike while you're in camp. And then having basically, it's kind of like you go to this job all the time and then all of a sudden you have nothing. There's nowhere to go and there's no nothing. And so it was just the strangest thing. And I wasn't one of the guys that was down there pulling signs or anything like that. But really, I just was kind of lost. I ended up actually driving back to my folks to spend some time with them because I just didn't know what to do. I mean, there's no place to go work out. There's no place to go run drills to keep in shape or anything like that. It was just the strangest season.
Yeah, and the 87 season kind of fell apart big time. I think you guys started off, you beat the Colts in Indianapolis. You come back here, you get the 49ers beat. Had some questionable coaching decisions. We'll leave it at that at the end of the game.
Okay.
Ended up losing the game. Do you think the dissension from the team was caused because of the strike, or do you think it was caused by those last 6 seconds before the strike?
I think it had to do with the strike. You know, it was uglier than what I thought it was going to be. I just figured it would just be a kind of a walkout. Maybe it would be settled in a matter of days. But actually, the rhetoric that both sides were using were pretty strong. And so I think there was a lot of people on both sides that were pretty pissed off.
Yeah. But we get to 1988. The Bengals had come off of, I think it was a 4-11 season, but it seemed like every game you guys lost was within a touchdown. So it wasn't like it was a terrible team, just a little bit of a mess there. A lot of people thought they were going to fire Sam Weish. They keep Weish. 1988 season, training camp. I mean, what was different about that one than 1987?
Well, it seemed like there was a lot more excitement. You know, like you said, that 1986 draft, a lot of these guys are maturing. And so you're basically turning these guys into mature players in the NFL. And basically there's a lot of excitement about it because we were strong at all sorts of positions. We had really, really good players at all sorts of positions. And so, you know, you had guys like James Brooks, and, you know, you had guys like Tim McGee. You know, those guys were blossoming into really good players. Joe Kelly was blossoming into a great linebacker. And so you basically, what you're looking at is, you're right, that 1986 draft, all of these guys are become blossoming into full-blown NFL players.
Yeah, and the game that really stands out to me, and every defensive player I've interviewed, they all say the key was the first game, the two goal line stands against the Cardinals. You want to talk a little bit about that game?
Yeah, it was tough. That was a tough game. I mean, it was pretty warm, and so you're just trying to be as tough as possible in that kind of spot. You know, when you get down to a goal line, especially nowadays the way they run offenses, it's pretty good chance that you're going to score. But back then, you know, the defensive rules and the offensive rules and how you could actually play dictated that you had a pretty good chance of actually stopping them. And so once you stop them, basically that puts the nail in their coffin, so to speak.
Yeah, and the thing that's impressive is the second goal line stand ended a game, like you said, probably 85 degrees, which means on that old turf at Riverfront Stadium, it was probably about 115.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, that happened on a number of times. Actually, the one thing that most fans don't know is that sometimes your soles on your shoes, your turf shoes, actually start to melt a little bit, and so they slide a little bit, so you have to go find a cool spot to go stand.
Well, I mean, the old turf at Riverfront Stadium was basically, I think they got new turf in between the 87 and 88 season. Was the turf in 88 any better? Because I know 87, it was basically just concrete painted green.
It had a little bit more padding, I remember that. It still had the baselines, you know, because it was a dual-use stadium.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, you have the turf monster come get you, and you trip over one of those things.
Now, 88 season, like I said, I mean, it was a special season in Cincinnati. It was the year people still remember. What's your recollections of the fans that year and just what it was like to be around the city?
Oh, it was a lot of fun to be around the city. It was a general excitement, you know, even though they claim that NFL players are superstars and all that stuff, but you still have to go out grocery shop and things like that. So you'd meet people that would know who you were, and they'd be real excited. I mean, even little kids would get real excited, you know. And it was just pretty amazing at how the city had kind of rallied around it, and it was such a disappointment when we lost.
Yeah, but you get to the playoffs. We'll go through the good stuff first. You beat Seattle in the playoff game, and then you play the AFC Championship against Buffalo. Now, the thing that always irritated me was Buffalo, of course, trying to outlaw what the Bengals had done all year with the no-huddle offense, and, of course, turn around 2 years later, taking it to Super Bowl and acting like they invented it. But what do you remember about the 88 AFC Championship game?
I remember it being cold, and I remember that they actually had a pretty good running game, the Bills did. And that's one thing that we really had to stop. They had Thurman Thomas, who's a very good running back. And so basically that was the big deal, was trying to shut down their running game. Of course, Jim Kelly is no slouch. He's a Hall of Famer. And so you always wanted to get to him.
Yeah, but really in 88, I think they were more of a running team than they were a few years later.
Yeah, and I think once Marv Levy figured out that Jim Kelly was a real slinger, a gunslinger. But they had big offensive linemen, and basically they just tried to plow it down the field is what they had to do.
Yeah. All right, so we go to the Super Bowl. Super Bowl 23, probably a childhood dream of yours to play in that game. I mean, outside of the crappy ending, what do you remember most about that day? I know a lot of times people talk about when they used to get introduced one at a time.
I remember getting introduced. That was pretty exciting. One of the things I do remember was not only Tim Crumrie's broken leg, but I remember how crappy the field was. That was an extraordinarily bad field to play on. When you were taking out chunks that were about 6 feet long and about 6 inches wide, when you were trying to do a pass rush, you just never could do anything to get any sort of leverage. And then I remember Tim Crumrie having a little discussion with him after he broke his leg. I walked up to him after he broke his leg, and his foot was pointing backwards, and he goes, I said, "Hey, Timmy, you broke your leg," and he looks up at me and he goes, "Yeah, no shit." And he stayed until halftime, because we walked in at halftime, and he was still on a stretcher in full gear without his helmet on, but he looked white as a ghost.
Yeah, I think they took him right after halftime, didn't they?
Yeah, right after halftime. I think he wouldn't stay till halftime. I remember after that, him wanting me to watch his surgery before they actually pounded a 15-inch bar into his leg.
I think
I'll beg off.
Wonder he didn't hold you there and make you watch it.
Yeah.
All right, you talk a little bit about Dick LeBeau. I mean, I've had a lot of guys like LeVon Kirkland, guys like that have been on and played for him. What was it like for you to play with him? What was your relationship like with him?
Oh, it was a very good relationship. He is a great guy to play for. There's a reason they call him a player's coach. He actually understands because, he played for about 14, 15 years in the league, set a whole bunch of records. But really, he was the consummate professional. Even if he was delivering bad news to you, like, you got to do this, you got to do that. He was the consummate professional. He wasn't one of those guys that would just start screaming down your throat, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, you left Cincinnati after the, 89 season?
Yeah, I got traded.
Okay, you got traded. All right. Was that just because Mike Brown didn't want to pay you? Or?
No, that was because there were a couple of corners that were holdouts. And so, basically, they contacted Tampa Bay and said, "We'd like to trade for one of your corners." And so,
was that the Rod Jones?
Okay, we'll take Jim Scow.
Was that the Rod Jones trade?
Yep.
Okay, so you're the reason we had a cornerback named Toast. All right.
Yes. I think, something? That was his nickname down in Tampa.
Yeah. He wasn't a bad player up here, I didn't think.
No, I think their expectations for first-round draft picks were just like Cincinnati's expectations. And so if you didn't live up to that first-round draft pick status, then they're going to go ahead and, pillory you.
Yeah. So what was your impression? I mean, you got to be around Paul Brown, Mike Brown. What was your impression of the Brown family while you were here?
Oh, they were lots of fun. Trey, who is the youngest Paul Brown, who I think still works for them, used to use my Jeep for dates during training camp. Well, his dad wouldn't buy him a car. I'm like, God, your dad's got all this money. He won't buy you a car. Here's the keys.
Well, I guess that's one way to make sure you don't ever get cut, though.
That's true.
So, let's see. All right. The one thing I always like to ask the players about with the CTE and everything, what's your impression? I know you're involved with the class action lawsuit, I think, against the NFL.
Yeah.
What's your impression? Is the NFL doing anything to make this better? And if they are they doing it just because of public pressure, or what's your opinion
on the
whole
public matter? Pressure. They don't like to have bad publicity for the NFL. They really don't like that. So CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is a brain disease, they don't know how to diagnose it. Not only do they not know how to diagnose it, they don't know causation. I'm going to go ahead and say having concussions every other day probably will do it, but they still don't have a medical study that says, yeah, CTE is caused by a whole bunch of blows to the head. And that being said, who says that you didn't develop CTE when you're in college or in high school?
Or peewee or high school. Yeah.
So they have some causation issues. Obviously, I'm an attorney, so basically that's how I look at it.
Do you think at some point the NCAA or maybe even some high school federations will get sued?
Yeah, I don't think – well, part of the thing about the NCAA is basically that's a voluntary organization, so they're not going to get sued and have a whole bunch of assets to go after. But the NFL certainly has assets to go after. Some of these high schools and, you know, federations and things like that, the NCAA does pay their officials a lot of money, but they don't generally have a boatload of money. That's why you go after the NFL, because they have boatloads of money.
Yeah. Badness just higher profile also.
Yes, very much so. It's the highest profile game.
So do you think there's anything that can be done in the way the game's played itself or more that could be done to protect the players?
Yeah, I was reading an article and trying to find some YouTube videos on it. Apparently the Seahawks have been putting
tackling.
On tackling clinics.
Yeah, I coach my son's high school team, and that's what we're going to this year, the rugby tackling.
Oh, good. Can you send me a video?
And another thing we're doing is the offensive linemen will always be in two-point stances.
Oh, how's that going to affect your running game?
It won't. I had Jim McNally on the show a while back. You're not going to find a better offensive line coach. So he sent me some stuff on that, and he says that he thinks it's what everybody should do also. So he thought it was a good idea. So if he does, who am I to argue with Jim McNally?
Well, that's true. He's got lots of experience.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, even if it hurts the running game a little bit, I mean, let's face it, at most high schools, there's not even one kid that's going to go play in the NFL and make a lot of money. So you kind of got to weigh
true.
The, you know, there's more important things than winning a high school football game.
Yeah, well, I'd like to see some of those videos. I always probably have to go out and look at them on YouTube again, but I'd like to see some of those videos to see exactly how that rugby tackling works. And if that works, that may actually save the game in the long run.
Well, see, if you think about it, rugby, they play with no helmets. And those guys hit as hard as NFL guys, but you'll never see one of them use their head.
Yeah, that's true. You never see that.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's just like if you played tackle football in the street when you were little, I mean, nobody's going in using their head because you got nothing to protect it. The problem is when you put a helmet on somebody, they have a false sense that they're safer and they can use that.
When they don't, because you always have the neck and you always have that coup contra coup injury. The only way I learned how to tackle is by spearing.
That's the way I was taught in Pee Wee in 1978, by the way.
Yeah, and so if that's the only way you learn how to tackle, that's the only way you know how to do it. And
yeah,
you don't
I was
know
taught
what's
to take my head and stick it in the chest of the guy running the ball.
Yeah.
Which
I still remember.
Probably not good for your head or your neck.
Do you remember Christian Okoye?
Yeah, we had him on the show like 3 months ago.
I tackled that dude one time. I got in the backfield. I was playing left end, and I got in the backfield. And I hit that dude as hard as I possibly could in his numbers. I speared him right in the numbers. I dropped to the ground, and he drug 8 guys to a first down. And I come back to the huddle, and I'm laughing. Everybody wants to know what's going on. I go, fellas, it's going to be a long day. That dude was a load.
Was that the 86 season opener?
No, I think that was the 88 or 89 season.
Okay. 88 would have been the game they upset us on, but Stanford Jennings returned a kick for a touchdown. I remember that one. But,
yeah.
So, I mean, so you think it is going in the right direction, but unfortunately it's being forced by public opinion, right?
Yeah, that's the one thing that does drive the NFL is public opinion. And so if you look at see how they handle some of the sexual assault cases and things like that, or if you see the Ray Rice case and things like that,
well, yeah.
Basically,
I mean, they were going to
get pilloried by everybody.
There was a film where they had to do some.
Yeah, and so they go ahead and say, okay, we have to do something. We do this. And then they find out as time goes on, hey, that probably wasn't the best thing, or we should have been harsher.
Yeah, and the thing was, that started off as being a 2 or 3 game punishment. Tom Brady might have known about some deflated footballs, and that's going to cost him 4 games.
It's kind of unusual, isn't it? By the way, the Second Circuit Court denied his appeal.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. So he's going to be suspended 4 games for something he may or may not have had something to do with in a game that was 45-7.
Yeah, who knew?
Yeah, so what they're going to do basically is it's kind of like an official during a game that decides to call a play or call a foul on a play that probably doesn't need to be called just to interject himself into the outcome of the final game.
The world
that's basically what they're
down.
Doing.
Yep, that's what's going on.
Yeah, and the thing is, people don't care because, and I think just like the court of public opinion would be even worse if people realized these were actually human beings they were watching playing and not a Madden game.
They don't look at that because one of the reasons is that helmet. Because that helmet makes you a faceless person.
Yeah. But, so hopefully they get that straightened out. But I know you went to law school. You're a lawyer now?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I dress up in suits and ties when I have to go to court.
Well, I thought everybody does.
No, there's a lot of people that don't. They don't get treated very well either.
Well, they might be the ones that are too poor to go, but
that's true.
Why they're there. But so what took you to that course after you retired?
Oh, you know, I like helping people, and so I figured practicing law and helping people navigate through the legal system is a good way to go about doing it. I do consumer bankruptcy and foreclosure defense kind of stuff, so I get people that are kind of panicky when they come in and see me.
Yeah, and you've been a lot busier over the last decade then.
Yes. They've changed some of the bankruptcy rules, but, yeah, we've still been pretty busy. Everything's going pretty well.
All right. Well, hey, Jim, like I said, number one, you played with Joe Kelly, so everybody's got a funny Joe Kelly story. You got one? I know Joe will be listening to this. So.
No, I'm not telling those kind of stories.
Well, you can. We've had a couple people tell them, but most of them tell me off
stories.
Air.
I told Joe I'm not telling those stories, and I'm not giving it up.
Well, I'll let Joe know. But
okay.
We'll try. Maybe write it down. I'll just write a book about Joe Kelly when he played with the Bengals.
Okay.
But during the season, we'd love to have you on sometime during a Bengals weekly show. We talk about
great.
The past game, the game coming up, and whatever team that the Bengals are playing. We'll talk to the former player about, you know, a game he remembers against that team. But if you're interested in coming on, we'd love to have you.
That sounds great.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Jim.
You have a great day.
You too. All right, guys, remember you can find all our shows on thegruelingtruth.net. Tonight we will have former Minnesota Viking wide receiver Anthony Carter. We will also have the Gridiron Moe Super Bowl trivia show tonight after that, so make sure you check out all those shows. You can catch us on iHeart, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher, everywhere you find podcasts. So make sure you check out all the shows, check out all the articles. Make sure you check us out with Anthony Carter. Once again, I want to thank Jim Scalf for coming in. So make sure you catch us next time on The Legend Show.